You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Hi, this is Jenna Ashkowitz, and you're listening to The Fabulous Invalid.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, Broadway's podcast, where we present essential conversations with a curated roster of the best, most important, and innovative theater makers working today, from actors to writers, directors, designers, and everyone in between. We took our name from the title of a 1938 play by Kaufman and Hart that has since become a loving nickname for Broadway itself. Always deemed on the verge of decline, yet always bouncing back, The Fabulous Invalid. I'm theater savant Jamie Dumont.
And I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with StageLeft.nyc and StageLeft the podcast.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jamie.
It's just us today.
I know. Yeah. We're back to, you know, back to what it was like when Jen was doing company.
Oh. I know. I love it. You know, Jennifer Smart is busier now in quarantine than she was when she was doing 8 shows a week.
I know.
She is constantly doing stuff for the Actors Fund, helping out with this. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah,
that's because she's such a good person, right?
That's very, very true.
And everybody loves her, so she's in demand, you know?
Yeah, including us.
But I'm so excited because this week we're chatting with my friend, who's a star of stage and screen. She's an author, activist, podcaster, and producer, Jenna Ashkowitz. Jenna made her Broadway debut in the 1996 revival of The King and I, and also appeared on Broadway in Spring Awakening and Waitress, before venturing into producing with Once on This Island, for which she won a Tony Award, Be More Chill, The Jungle, and The Inheritance.
But of course, she is most famous for creating and playing the role of Tina Cohen Chang for 6 seasons on the hit Fox TV series Glee. And in addition to her career as an actor and producer, she's also entered the world of podcasting and has been an activist for civil rights and environmental causes and an advocate for adoption.
And I have to say, to properly set up the conversation, when I said my friend, I meant that quite literally. So Jenna and I went to high school together. She was a year ahead of me, and we did several shows together. We had a very, very amazing theater department, and it was very close-knit. So she was like the little red to my baker. We were in The Baker's Wife together, the Stephen Schwartz musical that no one does. And just really, really good theater-going buddies and best buds at the time. And I've kept in touch, obviously, over the years. And I know, I'm sure we're going to talk about it, but some of my favorite memories of Jenna stem from us going into the city to see shows, which we did all throughout high school. We saw Wicked together for the first time. We saw Spring Awakening together for the first time. Jamie, you're going to love this. We saw Taboo together.
Wow. That's,
yeah, yeah. Just imagine like two like 16-year-olds just going to see Taboo, you know?
Tell me what you fear. I'll show you what to do. We don't do sincere. Everything taboo. Tell me what you fear. I'll show you what to do. We don't do sincere.
I'm still processing that your high school did The Baker's Wife.
Yes.
Like, what high school does that?
Oh my God. Our high school did Assassins. Our high school did the Laramie Project. We did a lot of really, like, you know, choicy material.
Yeah, good for them. And it was a Catholic high school.
And it was a Catholic high school. That's the thing.
See, that's I think where I'm stuck in how progressive all these shows are.
The head of our department was hired the year that the school opened. And a condition of his hiring in 1975 was that he would have total control over the productions, that the school would not interfere at all with his artistic freedom. So when we did Pippin, we did the Bob Fosse choreography, and we had all the curse words and all the sex, and it was a Catholic high school on Long Island.
That's amazing. Well, you know, this solidifies over and over again to me the importance of arts in education.
Yeah.
It's you cannot understate how important it is. Look at you. Look at how well you turned out.
Yeah. No, I mean, so much of who I am is because of that theater department. 100%.
I know.
And I'm sure Jenna
we've met.
Will say the same. Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh,
no,
for sure. And look, I mean, she's so accomplished and fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
I think we should waste no more time, and I think we should get to our conversation with her right now.
Let's do it.
Now I'm gonna teach you all about love, dear. repeat after me.
Jenna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yay. Well, I have to say, Jenna, right off the bat, that I am one of the privileged few who had the opportunity to see you as Penny the Swan in Honk the Musical, which if you don't know, the musical version of The Ugly Duckling. The year was 2001. I was a member of the stage crew. I was still in braces and battling acne, but I mention this because it's when I first fell in love with you and I decided right then and there we would be friends.
Yes. You know what? Were you on the makeup crew with me for something, or did I do your makeup for 1776?
I think you did my makeup.
I did your wrinkles.
Yep.
I did your wrinkles.
Yes. I was Samuel Chase in 1776, the fat delegate from Maryland.
That's right.
which is a fact our listeners are very familiar
That's
with.
That's right. We have talked about 1776 before. It's very seminal for our country and for me personally.
That's right.
For those who happen to miss the Holy Trinity High School production of Honk. So you actually made your professional debut at the age of 3. I was wondering if you could share with us how you got started in the business.
Yeah, I mean, it was like a slow burn. I started when I was 3. I used to be the little one at restaurants that would go up to other families and say hi. And so, you know, everybody be like, she's so outgoing and bubbly, you should put her in modeling. And so I started off in like a lot of print ads and, you know, back then there was like a good amount of money in print ads. So I ended up
the 90s, you know.
Oh yeah, exactly. But I had done like probably, gosh, over 500 print jobs and 100 national commercials by the time I was like 10 or 11. So it was just nonstop when I was a kid. And then I got into theater. And that's when I fell in love with Broadway, was when I booked The King and I, the revival in 1996 with Donna Murphy and Lou Diamond Phillips. So that's really when, like, you know, I felt like it catapulted into something a little bit more serious, rather than just like, you know, saving for my college fund.
The Royal Princes and Princesses.
The King and I is my absolute favorite musical, and I saw that 96 revival probably more times than I should admit to. I saw Donna Murphy do it at least 4 or 5 times. I saw Faith Prince do it twice. I saw Marie Osmond close it.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I'm missing a Mrs. Anna. There's somebody in there. I'm missing one of them.
It was Donna, then Faith. You're right. There was somebody else that I'm missing as well.
I'm
definitely saw me
because
I did. I was with Donna, and then I was with Faith for a very short period. Oh, no. I was just with Donna. That's right. I was just with Donna.
I saw you 4 times then is
what
I did.
That's crazy.
I know. I love that production. I love that show. It had to have been magical. You were 8 years old, if I'm not mistaken. Tell us a little bit about that. What was your favorite part of doing that show?
Yeah. Well, the good thing about that show, you know, kind of like The Sound of Music, there's just a ton of kids in the show. So like, it's like after school activities. I mean, I was in 4th grade. I was 9 and 10. So I was in 4th grade and I would go to school, and then my dad would pick me up and we would drive into the city, and he bought a minivan so that I could sleep on the way home, because it was a long show. It was a 2-hour and 45-50 minute show, right? Mm-hmm. It was just the weirdest thing, but there were 14 of us. And so there was a schoolroom. We had like 2 floors of the dressing rooms on the 4th and 5th floor. The Neil Simon had the elevator with the elevator operator named Lloyd. So like, we became friends with Lloyd, and like, everybody just lived for the children. And so we were treated like gold there. And like, we were brought into this family, and I got to see like what the Broadway community was all about at a very young age. And, you know, I think it definitely
taught me discipline and responsibility in a different way than any, you know, other 9-year old probably, unless there's, you know, a kid playing tennis at 9. But like, but it was, I think the most fun was like hanging out with these people that, I could call family. And, also like, I think about this now, like being around 50 cast, I think there are 52 cast members and 95% of them were Asian American. So like for me, it was like being around, I was adopted. And so my parents are Italian and Irish Catholic. And so being around 40 other people who looked just like me, who, you know, brought me into this world was like, I think it was really profound for me as a young child and really shaped who I was and my boosted my confidence, I think.
Haven't you noticed? Suddenly I'm quite a breezy because of all the beautiful and beautiful and news I'm learning about you.
That's such a unique experience, particularly back in 96. Yeah. You're very fortunate. I'm assuming those are all friendships. You've made friendships that have continued beyond that production in terms of the cast members.
Yeah, you know, it's strange now because I've actually gotten back into touch with a lot of people because social media wasn't around at that time. You really had to make an effort. And I was a kid living on Long Island going to school. So like, it wasn't like we could have dinner in the city. Like I was, you know, when I left the show, I was 10 years old. So, you know, now it's really interesting. All the women who played my mother and like, you know, all these cast members and dancers have families and kids that are grown. And, the littlest ones are now over 21, which is wild, because they were 3 and 5 when I was in the show.
Wow.
And, yeah, I've definitely kept a lot of friendships. Ironically, the one that I've kept the closest with is Donna Murphy. We just, you know, bonded really quickly during the show, and she really took to me, and I'm just so grateful and like to be able to have a role model like that in the industry, who's, I mean, obviously iconic at this point, and then to have her like a second mom really has been so wonderful. She's such a light in my life, so.
I will never forget when we went to see her in Wonderful Town, Jenna, and we went backstage and we got to meet her. And it was so cool because, you know, obviously we were meeting Donna Murphy, but it was so special to see the two of you interact because it was very clear to me that like, it wasn't a casual thing. Like she really was so invested in you. You know, we were in high school at the time, right? So this is before Glee. This is before, you know, you've done all these other amazing things since then. Like we were just high school kids who, you know, were doing the spring musical. And she took the time to chat with us. And like, it was a very special thing that I'll always remember.
Really, really special. I mean, for also people who don't know, like Rob and I don't know if you'll preface this at all, but like Rob and I, you know, obviously we're very close in high school, and like on our weekends, we chose to like take the money that we had saved and go and like student rush shows when you could student rush and go to the box office and get $26 seats or, you know, go to TKTS and see what was on the board. And we would go to our Hard Rock or Planet Hollywood, right? And we would get our food or dinner, and then we would go see shows and take the train home. And that was like a lot of our weekends.
Well, we have to talk about Glee, obviously, because, you know, it's Glee. And, you know, it was such a groundbreaking TV show, really, for its like weekly integration of musical performance into a scripted comedy drama series. It gave voice to so many different types of characters that you never really saw, you know, on the small screen. I was wondering if you could share with us a little bit about the casting process for that, because I imagine it was, you know, sort of unique for a TV show because it had so many different elements, not just being able to act, right?
Yeah. No, definitely it was. I mean, shockingly, they did not ask us to move or dance once.
Really?
Not once. I know. It's pretty wild. So basically, you know, there was the LA casting and the New York casting. I was, I had just graduated from Marymount Manhattan College in 2007. I had booked Spring Awakening as a swing in early 2008. I joined the cast, I think January 3rd. And I had been with that show. And I think the casting process started for Glee around in like April of 2008. And Jim Carnahan was casting it. And he had also cast Spring Awakening. So, I mean, he basically brought in our entire theater. Like, we were walking into Chelsea and or Jim's offices. And like, it was like, you know, the revolving door. Oh, hey, friend. Hey, Skylar. Hey, Alessandra. So it was pretty crazy. But I went in for Tina, and her two lines in the pilot are stutters. She originally was written to have Tourette's. And so, she has two lines and that was it. And unfortunately, I don't know. We didn't have to sing for our initial audition and our tape for Jim, because they knew we were on Broadway in Spring Awakening. So they were like, we know you can sing. So just come in and read for the lines. So, you know, when you have like one or two lines, you kind of look and you're like, oh, I got it. And it's whoa, 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 what? And I, that was, those were Tina's two audition lines. So I know. And she had Tourette's. And so I had to do some research on like, you know, what it's like for a girl to have Tourette's in her, you know, her teen years, and just because like I didn't want it to be an impression, I wanted it to be something that she, you know, actually emulated and had, you know, struggled with. So it was really interesting. But I did the one line, and I kind of forgot that there was two, and so he's like, okay, let's do the other one, and I was like, what? And that was it. That was the line. What? Wild. So,
well, you nailed it. Yeah.
You know what? I did. Exactly. I forgot about it. It kind of went away. And then about a month later, I got a call saying Ryan Murphy and the producers of Glee were coming into New York and they wanted to meet me. So I went in and I sang Waiting for Life to Begin, which is weirdly ironic after having produced, co-produced the revival. And because Tina has no lines, I sang, and, you know, it's like any normal musical theater audition where you probably sound like shit and the accompanist is on the wrong tempo and you're just singing and it's weird. But, you know, we got through it. And Ryan said, okay, well, since there's no lines for Tina, I would love if you could just improvise. And, you know, panic set in. And I was like, you know, stuttering with this Tourette's and saying like, basically what I improvised that my mom wanted me to join Glee Club because it would be good for me to make friends because of my challenges. So he was like, I just love that you made her so positive. And I was like, thank you. And I left. And then about another month later, it was really like 2-3 months, like I got a call and said, they're going to test your tape for studio, which is basically when you go in for TV, you go in, you go for the casting directors, you go for producers, and then they'll take you to the studio and you have to pass through the studio. And then usually the next day you'll go to network. And if you test, it's usually like down to one, two, or three of you for the role. So because I was in New York and I was literally in the show, they said, we'll test your tape for studio. And then if you pass, you'll find out, you'll get on a red eye tonight after your show and you'll test in the morning in LA for Fox. So I found out during the show that my studio tape had passed and that I would be flying to LA. So I flew, and that morning they put me up at the Intercontinental. I walked over to Fox. I tested with a bunch of other people, including Kevin McHale and Chris Colfer. I sang. Mm-hmm. I did the Tina stutters. I did the improv again. And I actually tested with Gideon Glick as well, who was for Artie. And within 30 minutes after we tested, I found out that I had gotten the show.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite a story. I have a quick sort of sidebar question. What was your go-to audition song in that period in your life? Was it Waiting for Life to Begin?
Goodness. What was that period of time? honestly, no, it was not Waiting for Life. And that was probably the first time I had sang that song at an audition. I just loved it so much. I had a big book because I had come out of college, and I think Fine Fine Line was my biggest 32.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. I love that.
I had a good mix. And so like she had that like pingy mix as well. And I was like, this is just gold.
You gotta go after the things you want while you're still in your prime. There's a fine, fine line between love and a waste of time.
And for pop at that time, because they were asking for a lot of pop or like contemporary Broadway, it was Hopelessly Devoted to You.
Those are great songs.
Thanks.
Love it. Wow. It's funny. It's also so funny to think of Hopelessly Devoted to You as a pop song because it's not really a show tune, right? Because it wasn't written for the musical. Right. It was written for the film. Right. But it's so equated to Grease in my mind that it anyway, that's interesting. Okay, back to Glee. I'm sorry. I
love that question.
I'm fascinated by the audition process. Plus, you know, don't take this the wrong way. You were very young, and those are such smart song choices. You know, I think it's really smart. And I think it's also says a lot about who you are, that you were very in tune with your strengths as a performer and when how to showcase that. And I just anyway, so thank you for indulging me.
thank you.
All right, back to Glee. Okay. Tina, she's a goth girl, right? Or started out as a goth girl, and that's very different, clearly, from who you are. So I'm curious, were there any things that you learned by playing her? Anything that she taught you as a character? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, actually, like going back even to after booking the pilot and going in, I was originally supposed to be a nerd. Tina was supposed to be a total nerd like Artie. She had mom jeans and she had head sneakers and sweater vests. And I think when Ryan saw the board of, you know, Artie and Tina, we looked too similar. It was like, it was too close to, you know what I mean? Like it just didn't, it wasn't dynamic enough for him, I think. And so I went in for a second fitting and our costume designer, Lou Eric, who does, I mean, every Ryan Murphy thing ever, she's amazing, was like, we're going goth. And I was like, oh my gosh. So my audition song in the pilot was, I Kissed a Girl from Katy Perry, but it was originally If I Were a Bell. And Tina was supposed to sing If I Were a Bell for her audition. and so it just totally shifted, which it clicked. It clicked for me. I was like, yeah, this makes sense. Because If I Were a Bell, like Rachel would have done, right? Like that.
Totally.
So it just totally like it gave it just another, it gave her another layer. I think what I learned from Tina, and I think I found more similarities than I thought I would with her and her character and with her and me kind of stepping into her shoes. Like I'm an extrovert, but I'm also like a massive introvert. I'm a little bit of both. And so obviously the misconception is that all performers are extroverts, right? Because we have to just be on, but I'm a total introvert. And so I really found that like we were similar in ways that like she would sit in the background and then when she had something to say, she would say it. And then she would kind of go back into the background again, you know? And so I like to call Tina an onion. Like you just peel back her layers, you learn a little bit more about her every time you like take another layer off, which is I think throughout the 6 seasons, we really got to see her evolve because she got more screen time and she, you know, she was a senior after those kids had graduated and she was like, I'm the queen bee now, like, you know, hear me roar. And so I think I found a lot more, I actually found that I was more similar to her than I had thought. I think that's what I learned. And I appreciated her. I think Jane Lynch actually said something to me that really stayed with me. She, in like season 2 or 3, when I wasn't really being written for as much as I probably would have liked because there were 18 of us at the time, she said, you know, you remind me of me. She said, you know, you and Tina remind me of me. You kind of sit in the background and then you come out, you wham, bam, punch, and then you go back. And I just like, that really meant a lot to me, especially coming from Jane Lynch, who has had quite the career to feel like you don't always have to be in the spotlight. You don't always have to be, you know, number one and kind of like down center all the time. So that was really helpful for me.
I imagine you having such a background in musical theater that must have really helped you get through all of that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it helped.
Not everyone did, right?
No. And here's the thing, like a lot of people, you know, Kevin came from music and he was in a boy band. So that definitely helped. And like, you know, Amber came from being a session singer for a long time. And so she, you know, she rocked in the recording studio and she has, you know, the voice of a lifetime. But, right. You know, it was helpful with the discipline and it was helpful with the regimen because like we just always showed up on time anyway. And like, in Hollywood, a lot of the time they have people who literally will take your hand and walk you from one place to the other because that's where they need you to be or else people wander. So for us, it was like, yeah, you know, being on time is 30 minutes early. And so that definitely helped. But having 6 weeks to learn a show on Broadway or, you know, some, you know, form of that or range, like, we learn these numbers in one day and we'd be like, we're perfectionists. I'm a perfectionist. And if it's not perfect, yeah. It's really frustrating. So I had to kind of like loosen up on my control issues with that because you learn a number with you know, having shot for 12 hours that day and worked and then having to learn this number, soak it in, go to bed, come back 12 hours later and do it, you know, at full speed. So it was pretty wild. But yeah, I think with the discipline, it definitely helped. We were like, all right, I guess we could do this. But for 6 years, I don't know how. I actually don't know how I did it.
But I see your true colors shining through. I see your true colors. And that's why I love. Let them show your true colors are beautiful like a rainbow.
Speaking of your 6 years on television and your career in theater, do you, looking at both of those, do you have a preference for one or the other? I mean, they're very different mediums. They take the same amount of discipline, but at this point in your career, do you have a preference for working in one medium?
It's a good question. I go back and forth every day. I think I like, I mean, at my core, theater is home. The stage is home for me. There's nothing like being in front of a live audience and getting instant gratification and getting that rush, you know, that you get when you perform. I think Glee was a juggernaut that was a once in a lifetime opportunity. TV can be great, but TV's schedules are shit. At least in my experience, like you can't schedule anything and you really are kind of like you're owned at that point. And not in a bad way. It's just that's your time is theirs. And so for me, I think I like that I know what a Broadway schedule is. And I know that like from 6 to 8, you know, 6 to 10 every night, like that's my time. And like, that's my time to work. I don't know though, because like when I did Waitress, it was like, oh wow, like you can't do anything else. Like a Broadway performer's life is really like you are dictated by the fact that you can't talk all day. You can't go and do all this crazy stuff all day long, which I don't, some people do labs and, you know, rehearsals for other shows during the day and then go to their show. And I don't know how they do it, but, I honestly don't know. It's a really hard question for me to answer because I love my life in LA and I love working in front of the camera, behind the camera, but there's just something that I think is like no other when you're on stage performing.
Well, one way that you have, you know, sort of stayed very involved in the theater is by becoming a producer. And I know you alluded earlier to Once on This Island, which I believe was the first project you co-produced. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. And you won a Tony Award. So, I mean,
yeah,
right out the bat. Yeah.
Right out of the gate. Thanks so much.
So what made you want to start producing for the stage among all the many hats that you've worn in your career to date?
Yeah. You know, I think it started kind of like during Glee. Like I started to use different parts of my brain that I had never used before as far as, you know, my craft. Like I knew how to perform. I knew how to sing and dance and act, but like just using the organizational part of my brain that was like, oh, I like connecting people. I like networking. I like putting things together. I like creating content. Like that was new for me. And so I started realizing like when I wrote my book, Choosing Glee in 2013, it was the first time I had started to like kind of step out on my own and go like, oh, there's other facets of this industry that I could really take advantage of that suit me well. And so that's when I started to learn about it. And then Hunter Arnold, who is the lead producer on Once on This Island, the revival, my producing partner, Ashley Latimer, she had been working with Hunter and joined this group called Uplift. And it's a producer initiative for the underrepresented in the producing world. So basically, Hunter decided that when Once on This Island was going to come to Broadway, that he wanted to bring in the underrepresented producers out there, because who is he as a 40-year-old white man to tell this story about this young woman of color from, you know, this Caribbean island? And so he wanted to go out there. And I think out of 13,000 producer slots, 3 of them were African-American that year. And so it was really jarring to him. And he thought, okay, well, if that's the case, then I'm going to make these underrepresented producers. And so we started Uplift. And Ashley had actually come to me looking for investors. And she was like, but actually, I think you'd be really great for this program. So if you want to join in, maybe we could go in on this together. So we actually co-produced this together as Eshkowitz Latimer Productions. And I had started a nonprofit called the Kindred Foundation for Adoption, which kind of stemmed out of this executive producer position I had on this documentary, Twinsters, where my best friend actually found her twin through Facebook. And they were separated at birth and adopted to 2 different countries. And they found each other on Facebook at 26 years old. Wow. And it was on Netflix. It world premiered at South by Southwest. And it's a really, really compelling and gorgeous story. And, you know, the fact that they could find each other, luckily that young, you know, you'd think like ironically 26 is not that young, but a lot of twins end up finding each other much later in their lives. If they were separated. So, sorry, I'm like going off on tangents here, but I started that, you know, foundation for, you know, adoptees for socio and economic, needs. And, Sam and I co-founded that together. And so I had started fundraising a lot and reaching out to people and had like, a small group of really amazing donors and people who were really invested in me and my projects. And so it really lent itself to coming on board for Once on This Island really quickly. I think I had a month to raise for Once on This Island. So it was really quick. And it was during Thanksgiving. So I actually gave myself 2 ulcers. No probs. But, you know, so yeah, that was Once on This Island. And then I kind of stuck with this program for a couple of years, and we did The Jungle on the West End and The Inheritance, but not through the program anymore. Ashley and I had to graduate. And and also did separately Be Marcel on Broadway as well.
Right.
It's been really fun, really fun.
So how do you go about picking which projects you want to get involved in? Because, you know, obviously you got two ulcers, right? It's a lot of work. You know, so how do you pick which show you want to
it's all about timing, and it's all about the stories. I think Ashley and I have really chose stories we want to tell first and foremost. And so Once on This Island, being quite as diverse as it was with a young woman at the helm of the show, was really, really interesting to me. And The Inheritance as well, the two-part that unfortunately, you know, didn't get an official closing night like many shows didn't. But also, gosh, really important, I think. It was a really important story to tell. And needed to be made and seen in the US. And so we got to, we begged Hunter for that one and for The Jungle as well, which is all about refugees, at this camp. So, it's really first and foremost stories, but then also with our investors and, you know, being a new producer, our network is quite small. So, you know, right now. And so we don't have a ton of people to reach out to over and over again. You know what I mean? Like
you have to be smart about it.
Pick the right people and obviously, but we've been really lucky with our network and the people who have supported us and the arts. So, you know, first and foremost, story, but also just timing too, you know?
Well, among your many hats that I alluded to earlier is the fact that you've also been somewhat of a pioneer of the podcast world. I know you and I had dinner like 5 years ago and you were talking about podcasts, and that's like before anybody was talking about podcasts. You were a co-founder of At Will Radio, and you've hosted now, I believe, three different shows, podcasts, Infinite Positivities, Epic Fail, which I loved, and your new show with Kevin McHale, Showmance, Glee Recap Edition. So how did you first get involved in podcasting?
You know, gosh, after I'd moved back to New York, and it was shortly before I booked Waitress, there was this time when I would, between the time that I had shot Hello Again, the musical movie with, you know, the wonderful Audra McDonald and Martha Plimpton and Cheyenne Jackson. I felt very lucky to be among those people. Pretty wild.
No big deal.
Gosh, I just love that musical so much, and I fell in love with it. And Michael John is just so wonderful. And so it was pretty wild. But I did that. And then there was this lull, and I don't really like to sit around. I really live on the principles of making your own opportunities. And so podcasting felt like the next venture, you know, after writing a book and performing a little bit. It was like, I felt like I had some more to say. And so we kind of framed the podcast after my book, you know, Living Your Most, you know, Happy and Positive Life. And so my friend Will, and I, he was the founder of At Will Media, it's now called. He was in New York. He lives in New York, and he was kind of taking a shift from the restaurant business into a more creative field. And we were sitting at lunch, and I said, "You know, I think I'm going to start a podcast. I really don't know a lot about it." And he goes, "That's so weird. I've been trying to build a podcast network." And it was kind of like kismet. It was just one of those things that you go, okay, cool, let's do it. So he was like, if you want to be a founding host on the network, I will also would love to have you on as a partner in the company. And so, you know, I felt very lucky to have a place that was already kind of set up for me to go in a studio. He built a whisper room and, you know, kind of just try this out. And he's really creative. And we, you know, we learned a lot by Infinite Positivities. I learned how hard it is to model a theme around a guest rather than like have a broad theme and have your guests come in and chat. I learned how to be a host for the first time and really gear like a shift, you know, lead a conversation. So, and then as Infinite Positivities came to a close, it was like, do we want to do this again or is it too hard? It's like a lot. And I really enjoyed it, but it was time to shift gears. And so we shifted to Epic Fail. And yeah. Same producers. It was at Will Media. And we just thought, like, you have all these amazing, you know, performers coming in telling really funny stories. So why don't we just, like, kind of, I don't know, just shift with that. And so Epic Fail was all these amazing performers telling us about the one fuck up that they had that they remember very, very vividly, which you just never forget. And then Showmans came about years later when I moved back to LA, and Kevin and I had just been looking for something to do together again after Glee. We're, you know, the best of friends, and you know, I think there any excuse to work with your friends is really great, and we've learned a lot about each other during the podcast. But the podcast initially was about couples who have met, and not necessarily like romantic couples, but work yeah. wives, work husbands, and friends who have worked together or met through work. And so we kind of wanted to just like explore other people's experiences that were similar to ours. And so that was Showman season one. And then we kind of shifted because the response from the Glee fans was just so massive. And you know, you got to give your fans what they want. And so anytime a Glee member would come on, it was like, talk more about Glee, talk more about Glee. And we were like, are we supposed to be doing a Glee recap podcast? And so we have, and it's done really, I mean, the response has been amazing, and we're having a really good time rewatching it. I mean, we're still in the early seasons, so we'll see how it goes later on. But so that's been the podcast world, and I'm really loving it. And obviously you guys know, and Rob, when you told me you were doing this, I was like, it just made so much sense to me for you to shift into, you know, your Stage Left blog and your reviews and your, you know, this. It's just, it just made total sense. So,
well, it's funny. You were one of the first people that we asked to come on our show, but at the time, you know, you still are primarily in LA, and we were trying not to at least initially do phone interviews. So like you said, yes, right away. And then we were like, oh, but you know what? The sound quality won't be as good. So we waited. And then of course, you know, a year and a half later, we have no option but to do a phone or online interview. So thank you for being an early booster of ours. And so glad we could finally, you know, get together.
I know. I mean, luckily it's some of the few things that we can do right now.
Right.
You know?
Yes. Exactly. It's a very safe way of connecting.
It's true. It's very true.
But Jenna, you make a good point because it is, you know, podcasting, it can be challenging, and you really do have to learn a new skill set if you're, you know, if you've not been a talk show host or done those kinds of things. And it can be very challenging, and you are spectacular at it, and your shows are great. Epic Fail is really a masterpiece, and it's well
so
worth glad. It's well worth checking out. But before we sort of draw to a close, we thought it would be fun, since we are in quarantine times, to play a little game. I'm gonna put a minute on the clock, and we're just gonna ask you a sort of a quick fire round of questions. Rob and
I
will go
so
back and forth.
I'm so nervous.
No, don't be too nervous. I mean, I think
you know all the answers.
Yes, yes, exactly. Okay, so I'm gonna start now. First Broadway show you saw?
Les Mis.
What's your go-to cast album?
Oh, you're a good man, Charlie Brown.
The Revival,
that
I
was
assume.
Weird. The Revival. And also Children of Eden.
Wow. So okay. So favorite snack food?
Kale chips?
There's no wrong answer. Favorite tattoo? I know you have a ton.
Oh, gosh. The Jason Robert Brown, Love is Always Better, on my arm.
Dream Broadway role.
Am I too old now? Kim and Miss Saigon.
It's the stage. You can be any age.
I don't know about that.
Yankees or Mets?
Yankees.
Burrito or sandwich?
Burrito.
Glinda or Elphaba?
Elfie.
First celebrity crush?
Ryder Strong.
I don't know who that Boy is.
Meets Boy Meets World.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. What was your worst non-theater job?
Working at a bagel store.
Favorite curse word?
Fuck.
Of course. And then this last one is probably the most unfair question we could ever ask anyone. Okay. Favorite Donna Murphy performance?
Oh, good Lord. fuck. Okay, I'm going to go old and new. So I'm going to pick two. I'm going to go with The King and I, Mrs. Anna. And I'm going to go with Hello, Dolly.
She was...
I mean, spectacular.
It's unbelievable.
Yes, it was... it's one for the books.
We need a pro tape. We need a cast album. We need all of it. Right?
We were just robbed. We were totally robbed.
I just want to live in that performance for the rest of my life. Jenna, I love the story at the very beginning of your book, Choosing Glee, where you talk about being a baby and your parents see you for the first time, mm-hmm. and you have a huge smile on your face. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that smile just has continued with you until this very moment. You are such a delightful, positive person. It's really been a joy chatting with you today.
Before
we let you go, though, we have a couple of final questions.
Great.
What was that show or thing that made you want to be an actor?
I guess the easy answer is The King and I.
What's the hard answer?
Yeah. I mean, I don't, I'd have to think about that. I like to make things hard for myself if you haven't figured that out. No, I think it was the King and I, you know, and then I think also, Les Mis, you know, bringing it back around, it was my first musical and I think I fell asleep in the middle of it when I was probably so young and, we were able to actually, Holy Trinity High School in Hicksville was the first high school production of Les Mis anywhere in the world. And so I was a freshman and Rob wasn't even in school yet. And
nope, I was at every performance.
That's right.
Of course.
That's right. I mean, Cameron McIntosh came and it was really, really groundbreaking and that was really cool. And so Les Mis also was a really important musical in my life.
And those are both great shows. We know there's no tune like a show tune. And do you have a particular show tune that's on heavy rotation in these difficult times we find ourselves in?
Oh, interesting. You know, I don't have a quarantine show tune right now. I've been playing a lot of Dua Lipa, to be honest. But if I had to pick one that I've played on loop a lot, when I was co-producing and raising money for Once on This Island, I was playing Michael in the Bathroom from Be More Chill. I think I've played it over 1,000 times now. So,
and how amazing is that? Because then you would become
weird,
a producer of Be More Chill, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
It's funny how things come full circle, isn't it?
Yeah.
My whole life is full circle. It's crazy.
Well, I have to share one more little moment of just serendipity is in 2006, I guess,
I don't know if you remember this, Jenna, but we saw Spring Awakening together. And the show had like literally just opened. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was our first time seeing it.
Yes.
And it was. I'll never forget, afterwards we stayed at the stage door because you knew Lea Michele from Broadway Kids, right?
Mm-hmm. She wasn't in Broadway Kids, but she was on, in Les Mis when I was in The King and I.
Ah, there you go. There you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we stayed after and we like said hi to her. And it was just so wild to think like 3 years later, the two of you were on a TV show.
I know. Well, I mean, and I was in Spring Awakening shortly after that.
Right. Exactly. I mean, yeah. Forget about Glee. You were in Spring Awakening. Right.
It's crazy. I was like, hey, guess what? Join your show.
Oh my gosh.
And
oh my
I booked Spring Awakening. I think it was January 2nd, and I left Spring Awakening on January 2nd.
Wow.
So I booked and joined the cast on 2008, and then I left in January of 2009, just before it closed. So,
did you do it with Hunter Parrish or did you do it with...
I did it with everybody. So I did it with the original cast. You know, they had won the Tony in July, right? June, July. And then I joined in January. And then I had Hunter and Alexandra Sosha and the new cast like Emily Kinney and Caitlin Kinnunen and you know, all those wonderful artists. Yeah, crazy.
Amazing. Well, crazy, I can't wait to see how many things we talked about today that will manifest themselves in the future, and we'll just keep making connections.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Yeah, this was so fun.
Thank you.
I'm just Michael in the bathroom. Michael in the bathroom at a party. No, you can't come in. I'm waiting it out till it's time to leave. And picking at grout as I softly grieve. I'm just Michael, who you don't know. Michael flying solo. Michael in the bathroom by himself.
Jamie here, that's our show. Thank you for listening. At this difficult time, please consider making a donation to the Actors Fund at actorsfund.org. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and the Fabulous Invalid LLC and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Charles Van Kirk. Find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid and on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcast. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday. Stay well and be safe.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.